Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. Engage.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation, a Star Trek podcast by a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Benjamin R. Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica.
Hi, Adam.
Ben?
Are we playing Marin Chicken?
Yeah, it feels like we are.
We could do cards, we could do Bible study, we could just talk shit about other Star Trek podcasts. I mean, we have lots of options.
So many other podcasts out there trying to step to this. Have you noticed?
Yeah. Well, that's why we're the people's champions, but maybe not for long, Adam.
What does the Bible say about enemies of of the Federation or the Enterprise? Maybe we can do a Bible study about that.
Man, I would really have to page around in here.
Are they scattered all around? Like, it's not like there is a book of enemies within the show Bible.
They don't really get into that. Oh, I got a page on Star Trek weaponry. Maybe we can dig into that.
Yeah, why don't you teach me about weaponry?
It's good to see you all in church.
It's called the Bible.
That's the way God wants it. I don't know why, dude.
All these questions? Is a little blind faith too much to ask?
Today's lesson is from page 69. Nice. Star Trek weaponry. So we've got phasers, Enterprise phasers, and photon torpedoes. So I guess phasers is about hand phasers, the ones that the away team carries. I guess the hand phaser and the pistol phaser. Huh. That's interesting. I don't think we've ever seen that. What about the phaser?
Yeah. Key fob is a super popular phaser. It's like the best phaser.
Yeah, you can put that in the waistband of your pants and walk right through TSA with that thing. They're never going to know it's there.
Yeah.
The Enterprise phasers are the ship's phasers, and they have all the power of the Enterprise's matter antimatter engines behind them. They're quite capable of disintegrating another galaxy-class vessels. Or even a small moon, if necessary. Dang. Take that, Star Wars. The one ship could blow up a small moon.
That's no moon.
It's too bad that the only glimpse of the weapons room that we saw was in that season one episode where Riker and Picard go to it when they think the ship's been stolen by the Binars.
Oh, yeah, they go to the...
But you never see the interior...
It's like when Gene Hackman is taking back over his ship and they go to the small arms locker.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish we got the interior there. That's just great cheap filmmaking, though, to just show the exterior and have people headcanon their way through that.
Yeah, we'll just put a label on this room and let the imagination do the rest.
Right.
Let's see. The photon torpedoes are perhaps the single most powerful weapon available to the Enterprise. It's a tiny piece of antimatter held in a magnetic bottle. Wow. I didn't know that. Built around a miniature warp engine and can be used to track and destroy an enemy vessel while either it and or the Enterprise are traveling at warp speeds. There's a single tube forward and one firing aft. Each tube contains 10 fully activated torpedoes.
You don't ever see the torpedo bay in the show, do you? They save that for the movie, right?
Right.
Yeah, it's too bad. They're also shooting people in those, too. That's an effective mode of transport, we've learned.
Yeah, if you got to get a Spock off your ship or a half-Klingon babe on, put them in a torpedo.
Yeah.
Well, Adam, this has been Bible Study.
Peace be with you, Ben.
And also with you.
Why don't we do what we came here to do, Ben? Let's discuss the Season 5 cliffhanger. It's Season 5, Episode 26, Time Zero, Part 1. First duty of every Starfleet officer is to the truth, scientific truth, or historical truth, or personal truth. Ben, what were your expectations for this cliffhanger, like when you were a youth watching the show for the first time? Because I think the show quite accidentally or intentionally built up the expectation that when you get to the end of a season, some crazy shit's gonna happen.
Well, crazy is right, Adam. I don't know. I'm not able to put myself in the shoes of a contemporaneous Benjamin on this one. I really vividly remember my experience of Best of Both Worlds, and.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember watching Time Zero Part 1, but I don't really remember having any feelings about it. And I feel like maybe that might be our friends Dave and Graham of Stop Podcasting Yourself, I feel like, talk about this a little bit. Like, when you're a kid, there's, like, shows that you love, but basically all TV is pretty good to you. Like,
right.
Movies and TV are great. So you're like... You're not as critical of things as a kid. And I think that this is one of those ones where it seemed like perfectly acceptable Trek to me as a kid. But looking at it now, I can see lots of flaws.
Yeah, this really feels like a Socks for Christmas episode to me, you know?
Socks for Christmas Part 1?
Yeah.
It's all lefts.
Mistitled.
Well, the entrepreneur is back at Earth again. And this is a mission that they've been called for specifically, but it's a little unclear why. Like, Picard doesn't hint at why it's unusual that they would be called for this, but it should seem unusual for him, right?
The only reason you get called back to Earth should be conspiracy with the nubbins, speaking at a Federation Academy graduation,
right.
Or, I guess, archaeology?
Right. And that's because the random Federation science guy is slow-playing a big reveal.
I bring the Enterprise all the way home. As we continued our excavation, we found one other thing I haven't shown you yet.
Fuck this guy 1,000 times for what he does here.
I hate it. I hate it so much.
It's like he does the Price is Right thing where you're like, you're excited to go up and play the pricing game, and it's like a chest of drawers are possible to win. And then there's like a year's supply of Rice-A-Roni and then a brand new car.
Right. It's crazy that he does it. I mean, it's like, it is, I feel like, walking tour guide level suspense building.
Yeah.
And what they're doing is they're walking around an archaeological dig in San Francisco, and this guy is explaining that they dug into this. Nobody's been in here for 500 years, and it's full of little artifacts. There's like, you know, pocket watches and eyeglasses and things in there. And There's like a gun, and
they really don't observe firearm safety with that gun either. They're just all waving it around.
That gun is definitely rusted out, Adam. I can't imagine after sitting in a cave. I mean, I'll tell you a story. When I was about 15 or 16, my father decided to replace the furnace in our house
with a gun.
And he was
out back and shoot some of them logs, Ben.
he was like going through the ducting, and like, you know, I guess our house was old enough that something had to be changed about the ducting to accommodate the new furnace. And in the like air vents, in the air ducts in our house, he found two lock boxes. One was just full of cash, and the other was full of like old coins and a diamond ring and a gun.
Wow.
Yeah. The way he revealed this to me was I was sitting downstairs, probably watching Star Trek, and he just walked in with this crazy rusty revolver.
Whoa!
Yeah. It looks just like the revolver in this scene, and I fucking shit myself. It's like the craziest. Like, my dad is not a prankster. He's not a madcap kind of person. This was
neither
like
is
basic...
he a gun person, quote unquote.
No, this was one of the craziest things he's ever done. It was in retrospect very funny, but in the moment I was shocked and horrified.
Your dad is awesome. I can totally see him doing that. But I also have a question about, like, did he get on the floor with you and dump out the box and show you all the shit, or was he like, this is for me to discuss with your mother? Sort of vibes about
No, we got to go through it. I mean, it was great. It was
wow.
There was basically like a source of $100 bills for me to like find projects to earn for a while in high school. Like, I'd be like, I'll mow the lawn and do and trim all the hedges if you'll give me one of those hundos.
Jesus Christ, I was underpaid for my chores. Oh my God.
but they were like so old that they didn't pass the pen test. So you had to take them to a bank to get them changed into real money.
Wow.
They were like there was nothing in these boxes that was from more recent than like 1948 or something.
Did you ever attempt to find out who the previous owners were for the house? Like, not that you would give the money back, because that'd be stupid, but like, like to figure out like sort of its lineage?
Yeah, I don't know if any of that research ever got done. I probably didn't care enough at the time. I'd be really fascinated to find that out now. But
do you feel comfortable declaring how much money it was? Was it like thousands of dollars?
I'm going to guess it was probably like $5,000 or something like that. I mean, Oof. It wasn't like a life-changing amount of money. It was just a whole lot of money to find, you know?
Was that also the ring that you proposed to your wife with?
I don't know. I don't know if that ring is... I mean, my parents maybe still have it, or maybe they sold it. I know that they sold all the coins. They like went to one of those weird retail stores where you're like, why is this here? And sold the coins to one of those guys.
They didn't go on that PBS show.
But all that is to say, I totally believe that this gun was not in a fissile state when they pick it up in this episode.
What did your dad do with the gun?
I don't know. He might still have it for all I know.
Wow. Would you mind checking in on that? And like, maybe we make that the cliffhanger to the podcast. Like,
ooh,
maybe
yeah.
Maybe for part two, you can give us an update for the Marin Open.
Okay. Well, I'd say that there's as good a chance as any that the answer is not satisfying or interesting.
And just like our case, show.
If that's the case, we'll edit this out. But if it is, you can. And if you're hearing this, chances are pretty good that there's an interesting payoff to this anecdote. Or at least something that's interesting to me personally.
The episode we're talking about remains to be seen whether or not there is an interesting payoff to be had here. But
well,
a very interesting beginning, right?
Right. So the big reveal here, the scientist like whips the fabric away, and the other thing that they found in this cave is Data's head. Incredible.
You would think that Maddox would be down there just humping the shit out of that head, right? Like,
give me that head. Gotta get that head.
Anytime there's a data part, you think he's got to be first on the scene, right?
He's like first on the organ donor list for data heads.
Yeah.
If any data head should become available. I think that this scene is a turkey, but it like this moment begins a tone that is really good. Like, there's a really good creepy whodunit mystery tone at the beginning of this episode.
If you're not laughing at the head, I think you're in from this point.
Right. There's a lot of finding Data's head, right? Like, they find Lore's head, they find Data's head. There's that terrible movie where they find another Soong-type android head.
I saw that head in real life at the at the MoPop in Seattle. Their Star Trek display.
Mm.
It was in the floor.
Cool.
Yeah. Didn't look any better in person.
What is that about? Like, why, if you're making the program Bones, is it possible to get a completely believable head? But if you're making the program Star Trek The Next Generation, the head is going to look like a styrofoam garbage head.
It's really just an allocation of resources, Ben. I mean, if you have budget dollars dedicated towards a hyper-realistic Samuel Clemens costume, and and you have a choice to make between that and one of the main characters of your show, I don't know. I think you probably throw it at Clemens, right? And his giant cigars.
Spoiler alert.
People don't care about that.
So they're like, there's a lot of research to be done, and it's almost like a crime procedural, the way this episode proceeds at this point.
Yeah, it's a little CSI Star Trek, isn't it?
It totally is. Like, so they've got the head down in engineering. Geordi's like piping in with little pieces of information he's finding.
I have found out a few things.
Data is. You know, talking Riker and the captain through the time paradox angle.
At some future date, I will be transported back to 19th century Earth, where I will die. It has occurred. It will occur.
I love that they put Data's head on one of those plastic stands that they use for ice cream cones. When you got to scoop out a bunch of them and stick them in the standee while you're paying for them. Like, that's right, where Data's head is.
You can't do your wallet and hold a cone at the same time. Yeah. And Data has kind of an interesting reaction to this. He's basically saying, like, this is actually kind of great for me because I've, you know, while you can all rest assured that you're going to die, I've had to live my entire life not really knowing. And now I know. I'm gonna die.
It feels like Data's playing both sides of the emotional coin a little bit. Riker's issue with Data is like, how can you be so dispassionately working on your head in an ice cream cone stand and not like have any feelings about it? And Data's like, well, actually, it gives me great relief to know that my life will come to an end because, you know, it's sort of a dreadful feeling knowing that I'm going to outlive all of my friends and then have to make new ones and then outlive them as well. But, like, that's an emotional outcome too, right? So it feels like he's picking and choosing which emotions to feel.
I mean, we've talked a lot on the show about how Data's lack of emotion is maybe, like, the most overstated thing.
Yeah.
And that facade has begun to really crack in season 5. I mean, we talked a couple episodes ago about Data doing a bit on Guinan. But like, they have given him a weird needle to thread in this episode because everybody is feeling very strong emotions and they kind of want him to walk around acting like it's just a total shocker that they are. And he's been around long enough to know that people feel strong feelings when people die, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's been through this before.
Yeah, and not only has he been through it before, the crew has been through it before. So for Riker to be so surprised that Data's not feeling things the same way that he is, I don't know, comes off as a little as strange.
It's written in a way that makes you feel like, did this person watch any Star Trek before they wrote this?
Yeah.
Or did they just get, like, very general descriptions of the characters?
It's either that or it's just writing to a new viewer sometimes, which is, like, that lowest common denominator target, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
Which makes it so frustrating for people who've been here the whole time.
Yeah. There are episodes that build off of everything we know about these characters, and then there are episodes that reset everything about these characters to, like, the most basic version of them.
Right.
And the ones that build off of what we know about them are always more interesting and more rewarding.
Yeah, and that's a thing that television, I think, has gotten right since this show was made. Like, there is far less of an expectation that a viewer
has never seen a frame of this before.
Yeah, and there's sort of an understanding between show creator and viewer that either you're in from the start or you're not going to get it, and we're not going to, like, write to your level, which I think is great and rewarding, and it's part of what makes TV so great right now. So what do they find out in this head, right?
They find some
bacteria, like, on it, right?
Yeah, they find some, like, dino DNA, and they find a fossil of some weird creature that only exists on one planet, which is great. It's like when the bad guys use an explosive that's only sold in one very specific store or whatever.
Yeah. They're like, there's literally nowhere else the story can go than back to this planet, and so they do.
Yeah. So they're like, they put the ship in gear and they head off, and as they're heading there, Geordi and Data decide to go get hammered and tend forward. And they're talking through this, and Data's like, no, like, this is awesome. Like, I've been confronted with my mortality, and I find it to be a great comfort, despite what you might think. This is great. And Data gets called away, and
what's weird about that is that, like, sure, there's comfort in it, but because no one can be sure when Data will die, only that he dies in the past, like, there's sort of a sword of Damocles held over him, like,
right,
from this point forward. And that's what Geordi is a, that's what Geordi and everyone else, I feel like, has a hard time with. It's less that Data will die, but it is more that he will die at any time, and even
right
now.
It's less that Data has to pay his taxes. It's that, unlike everybody else, Data's taxes could be you any day.
Right.
At least we have the comfort of knowing that it's not until April 18th. Mark your calendars, folks.
So they pull up to the planet, and they scan it for life forms.
Yeah. They scan it, and Data's going, life forms. You precious little life forms.
I'm sorry, Ben, I lost you again.
The transmission dropout?
Yeah. Yeah. Planet's totally desolate. There's nothing there except for this little spot, this little blip that's throwing off some space-time signatures.
Oh, well, we should talk about the little interaction with Guinan before we hit that, right? Because she walks up to Geordi in 10 forward, and she's like, what's going on? Why were we at Earth? And Geordi's like, oh, we found Data's head. And she's like, oh, it's on.
Full circle.
Yeah, she seems to know something significant about this.
Yeah. For all the problems I have with the way the characters are dealing with this scenario, I think that the tone so far is cool, and I really like this push in on Guinan, like this like I'm a creature that lives to some extent out of time, and this, like, reminds me of something in that weird out of time way. Like, that's so fun, you know?
Yeah, and I think your point also means that, like, it's sort of setting a pretty high bar, right? The tone is cool. The setup is cool. Things are building into something that we hope is very interesting and fun.
Mm-hmm. So they beam down to this spot, and it's like your classic Star Trek styrofoam cave, which is weird because they've already had one cave in this episode and it didn't look styrofoam, but this one does. So they're like scanning around this cave and they're like, well, there's nothing here. And Troy's like, not so fast. I think there in fact is something here and I can sense it. And Data has been kept off this mission because they're basically like, there's no precaution too small that we can take to keeping Data from dying 500 years ago. And he's like scanning for them and he's like, hey, like, listen, I could actually, there's a chip in my head. The deal is there's life forms down there, but they're slightly out of phase with our time continuum. And I could use this chip in my head to phase out and see what's going on, but you didn't send me down there, so I guess you're SOL. Sorry, guys. And then that's the end of the episode.
Data's like, if I can just combine the chip in my head with this Bop It game, I'll be able to slowly dial in my phase in line with everything else down there. And it's a cool premise tied to a scary premise, because just moments ago, Troy is freaking out because she's sort of like a retriever pointing at dead bodies. She's like, there are actually tons of dead people here, and they're right. Human.
These people are terrified of something.
Yeah.
And so Picard, like classic Picard, rolls his eyes. He's like, all right, Data. You can go down to the goddamn styrofoam cave. Just be really careful, okay? And
he fits him with some water wings and and like a styrofoam helmet.
My mom says the tags you gave me weren't enough.
Yeah, they duct tape a pillow under his butt in case he slips and falls.
Yeah,
and
that pillow would be better served duct tape to Marina Sirtis. Given her frequent butt-related injuries.
They get him down there. They plug him into the Bop It, and he like phases out. And it's kind of like a cloaking thing where he kind of slowly disappears. And he's, I guess, rigged it so that he can radio back to them, but they can't talk to him. And he's like describing what he sees, and he's saying like, "Oh, there's some weird aliens, and there's a snake, and the aliens have holes in their heads, and it's a weird deal down here in this other time period."
They're sending a guy who wants to die into a place where they aren't sure that he isn't going to die in the process. Like, what do they think is going to happen?
It's a fun scene because it's Data describing all of this tense, weird stuff. Like, you get a lot out of the hearing him explain what it is and not seeing it.
It is releasing what appear to be energy fragments, which are then ingested by the entities through the orifice.
I bet he'd be a great story time person at like an elementary school.
An Ewok treehouse.
Yeah, he's really descriptive. Like, I get the feeling that he would use voices and stuff.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, Imanomachu Vedakon Yumnum.
For the characters.
He would do the sound effects of the AT-ATs.
Yeah. Yeah. He would skip the part of the text that says turn to page 4.
This page intentionally left blank.
Yeah. So they lose touch with him, and the Bop It blinks back into normal time.
Data!
The Bop It's the only thing left.
Yeah, and for all they know, he dead.
Yeah.
My love is a fever, long until for that which longer nurses the disease.
A big time bummer, Adam.
And Picard has got to feel like shit about this. Like, he lost him in a day. He finds out Data's gonna die. He takes it upon himself to institute whatever life-saving measures he can to prevent Data's death. And all it took was like 4 hours.
Yeah.
Before he got him killed. Bad feeling.
Yeah. Well, Adam, this is the point at the episode where they might as well just be playing Yakety Sax for the soundtrack for the rest of for the rest of the time. Data wakes up in like immediate post Gold Rush San Francisco / backlot on a movie studio.
Yeah, it's real Universal Studios vibes.
Yeah.
And like the first guy he runs into is like the goddamn drunk driver's guy from Back to the Future. Like,
yeah.
Totally hoboed out.
Yeah. Oh,
he's great.
Man. This is what I would call, Adam, a very ambitious tone shift, because they've gotten a few things wrong so far, but a lot of it was going oh so right, you know?
Yeah.
They were doing Star Trek as a place, and let's do a crime procedural in space. Let's undiscovered country this bad boy. Let's do something really out there, really cool. And when Data starts wandering around San Francisco, brushing the fucking straw off his pants and interacting with drunk hobos, it's just like, what? wait.
It's real, like, genre whiplash, right?
Yeah. It is, like, it is the stripper glitter metabolizing the ship, shifting into Luoxana crap.
Yeah.
Of this episode.
Yeah. Yeah, because the whiplash occurs because the senior crew has witnessed a death that they had hoped to prevent. And what we get is like some real slapstick Data playing poker and Data winning at poker and like Data turning into...
Oh, here's a racist character. Here's a like dapper Southern gentleman character.
Data going full Doc Brown from Back to the Future. Like,
yeah.
It's a... Right, it goes,
like every character idea and premise in the past thing is stolen from another thing and mostly Back to the Future.
Yeah. Yeah, it really is.
It's so shameless.
It's just missing the manure. The manure is the only thing that's missing, Ben.
It's weird. Data has decided to announce to everybody that he's French, and this is another just like conveniently like Data is incapable of lying any other time it's ever come up. Now he's just lying, you know?
Yeah, it comes very easy to him. I wish we saw some of the poker scene, though.
Yeah, like what the poker game was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really just like smash cuts from him walking up to the table to him like walking out with a crazy hat and vest.
Like every other episode we get 20 minutes of poker.
They get all of the retrograde social mores of the poker experience, but none of the actual poker.
Right. Right. Just the flavor.
Yeah. But Data has made enough money off of this poker game with a bunch of bums in the back of a hotel to be a fabulously wealthy man. And he starts whipping out Fliff and giving it to the bellboy at the hotel that he checks into. He's like, get me this stuff. I'm an inventor. I'm going to make technology.
There's a thing here that they don't even touch on, which Back to the Future does very well, which is like the danger of going back in time. Like Data basically is the sports almanac incarnate in the past. He seems to have no regard for changing the timeline that he's in at all. He appears to be constructing some sort of machine whose intent is a mystery to us at this point. Like,
right.
What do you think his intentions are?
I don't know. I mean,
it's certainly not to lay low.
Is it like, is he building a time travel device to get back to the 24th century?
If it were that easy, wouldn't he be building time travel devices when he was in the 24th century with actual like 24th century gear?
Right.
Fairly problematic, Ben.
Picard is bumming out, and he thinks maybe I'll go get something to drink, take my mind off matters. And he wanders down to 10 forward, and Guinan is in there like inventing cocktails. She's got like easily a dozen drinks out on the desk, and she's working on one that is like, it's meant to evaporate the second it hits your tongue, and it's like a very delicate balance because the species of the person drinking it might be different, and therefore they would have a different like average body temperature, I guess.
Yeah, this is a really cool scene. I mean, this is like the difference between, you know, someone who cooks and someone who is a chef.
Yeah.
Like a chef is someone who comes up with their own recipes and ways of cooking. And
right.
Guinan is like a real cocktail person. Like, she's inventing stuff,
yeah.
I feel like. And that's next level stuff. That's stuff I couldn't even hope to do.
Yeah, she's like inventing the sous vide equivalent of cocktails or something.
Yeah.
And there's some cool special effects with this. Like, she like sprinkles some stuff in and it like evaporates all at once, you know?
She's using the drink she's making as a metaphor for this appeal that she's making to Picard, which is that she asks him,
"Do you remember the first time we met?"
And Picard's like, "Yeah, sure." And she's like, "I don't think you do, actually.
You don't know shit, asshole."
Yeah, need I remind you that I exist out of time? And so she's like, "How much do you trust me? Do you trust me all the way? Do you trust me enough to accept some very opaque advice about..."
Do you trust me from one side of my hat to the other?
Yeah. She's like, "I can't..." She's like, "I refuse to tell you more than this, but you need to go down on the next away mission, because if you don't, you and I will never meet." And Picard's like, "Okay." And then he just turns around and leaves. There's no questioning.
Yeah. I love how much Picard trusts Guinan.
I do too. Like, I laugh about it in the moment, but Guinan's mysticism and that what she says is taken for truth every time is one of the most fun parts of this show.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it is something, like, I'm really glad it's a part of her character and their relationship. It breaks my heart that device has fallen into the hands of whoever wrote this and whoever wrote Star Trek Generations, because
yeah.
It gets abused.
Yeah, especially because everything was set up so nicely. Like, it wouldn't take much to just continue great storytelling with her.
Right.
And instead, the baton's taken and they just throw it into the bushes.
Yeah.
"I am the cutest of all. You will assist us. I am the cutest of all.
We cut back to California, and Data's like making up some technology, and he's like about to set a sandwich down on a newspaper when he spots a picture of Guinan in the newspaper announcing some kind of literary hang, and he's like, "Oh, shit."
Yeah, I mean, back in old-timey San Francisco, you got your literary people together for a salon. You got some finger sandwiches and a nice punch.
Yeah.
You just listen to people talk.
This is no Paris, but we're going to try our darndest.
Right.
This is like the rare Data squint to commercial.
Yeah, his mouth is a little bit agape.
Yeah.
That's about as much as you get from him in terms of Riker squints.
And like, as silly as this episode has gotten, we come back and the silliest shit in the fucking world is happening. They've got this absurd caricature of Mark Twain hanging around at the salon, and he's having this big back and forth with Guinan, and it's like a dumb person writing about two smart people talking.
"According to our best geologic estimate, the Earth is approximately 100 million years of age. Perhaps it is less, perhaps more.
Perhaps a great deal more.
Indeed.
They bring back Jerry Hardin for Samuel Clemens, which is great. I mean, this is not Jerry Hardin's fault.
I don't know, man. I think that the performance is so far over the top.
Oh, no. Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not trying to ride for Jerry Hardin's Samuel Clemens here, but this was not this was not the weak part of the scene or the episode to me. I think this was equally weak.
Now, if you'll permit me, I'll continue my character assassination unimpeded.
Yeah, I don't want to be too cruel. I think that the text is where the problem arises from.
Yeah.
But it's not really an actor inhabiting a historical figure. It's an actor doing a caricature of a historical figure.
Absolutely,
like,
yeah.
I refuse to, like, I've never heard a recording of Mark Twain speaking, but I refuse to believe that anybody has ever spoken like this in history.
Yeah, it's real village theater type stuff.
Yeah. So, I guess Guinan is here as some kind of literary figure, and so is Mark Twain. They're having some big time hangs, talking science, and
Guinan is basically wearing football shoulder pads. Like, she's looking like Legion of Doom in there.
Yeah, she's the local Oakland Raiders uniform at the time.
To what degree of believability is it that someone who looks like Guinan would be invited and welcome in a activity like this at this moment in time?
I don't know. I mean, like, I feel like the willingness of Hollywood to obscure the racism of the past may be at play.
Yeah.
I don't really know, like, I mean, Mark Twain, maybe Mark Twain wasn't like that, and maybe San Francisco wasn't like that at this time. Like, San Francisco's been out ahead on social issues for a long time. I don't know how far back that goes.
I mean, because we know, like Mark Twain's casual racism, you know, like they don't mention any of that in his character building,
right? Yeah, I mean, like, Hollywood does this all the time.
Yeah,
they
it's convenient.
They make it seem
for
like
conflict.
It wasn't the worst ever to be black in the past.
Yeah,
and that's a way that, like, white Hollywood helps contemporary white people feel okay about contemporary race relations, I feel like.
Right. I mean, I guess in bringing all this up, my question is, does she have to be in a writer's salon for Data to find her? And, like, could she instead be dealing with the many challenges of being her in this moment in time and somehow underpin the story with a little bit more, you know, conflict or challenge or something?
Yeah.
Because for right now, Data's time in the past has been nothing but a Disneyland ride.
Yeah.
Like, this is Frontierland.
He walks into the salon and he's like, yo, I heard Whoopi is in here. I'm a big fan, but I'm also a personal friend.
Yeah.
I got to see Whoopi. And the guy working the door is like, I'm sorry, we don't have you on our list. What was your name again? And Data's like, Abe Froman, the sausage king of Chicago.
Data, like, does sort of a football spin move around him.
Yeah. Neon Dion Data.
Yeah. And I guess just leaves him in the dust.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, once Data starts talking about spaceships around Guinan, she's like, I got to talk to this guy in private. You guys all clear out.
Starship? What registry would that be?
Of course, Mr. Data. Excuse us. We have so much to catch up. Excuse us. Just how are you?
And so she, like, grabs him and they run out of the house, and they're, like, out in the courtyard rapping about what's going on. And Data's like, oh, so you didn't get sent back from the 24th century. You're just super duper old in the time that I know you. I didn't get that. I'm sorry. I didn't understand how old you were.
There seems to be a little bit of temporal lag with Guinan too, because initially, she does not understand what Data's deal is. And then, when they're outside on the patio talking, she asks Data if her dad sent him, and that she alludes to not being done with her listening, like, as sort of a callback to her race of listeners.
Yeah.
Vibes. Like, there's, man, in like 20 seconds, you get just a tantalizing amount of a little bit more of her backstory here. Yeah. As she sort of snaps too, like, she suddenly understands that Data is who he says he is.
Yeah, she's like, what kind of thing are you? And he's like, oh, I'm an android. And she's like, dang, weird.
Yeah.
But so it becomes clear that this is contemporary to 1800s, whatever, Guinan.
Yeah.
And Data, like, misunderstood what he read in the paper. He thought that there were entrepreneur people hanging around San Francisco looking for him. Didn't question why the bartender would be among them, I guess.
She doesn't often go on away missions.
Yeah.
Especially the life-threatening kind.
Mm-hmm. But he explains his situation, and then they catch some smoke wafting over, and they realize that Samuel Clemens has been dropping some eaves.
Eavesdropping is by no means a proper activity for a gentleman. Nonetheless, the deed is done.
Yeah, he's just smoking blunts, hanging out on the veranda.
Sir, you'll have to take that outside.
Yeah, not a good moment, because this is exactly the sort of conversation that you do not want open for eavesdropping.
Yeah, you don't want somebody that's got Connecticut Yankees and King Arthur's courts running around in his mind catching wind of something like this.
Yeah, yeah, this is going to make his next book. And you're not going to get anything.
Yeah.
This is becoming a speech.
You're the captain, sir. You're entitled.
Not entitled to ramble on about something everyone knows.
Back in the Styro Cave, the entrepreneur crew is getting ready to... They've like worked out a way to reproduce the special thing in Data's head so that they can phase into the time that he was in. And they're getting ready. They're like setting up all the jumbo crayons, and Picard beams down and he's like, Guinan told me I've got to be here for this. So I'm taking your place, Worf. Get back to the ship.
Worf seems pretty pissed to be left out of this mission, but Worf hasn't been a going concern for many episodes now. He's like, take this one off, Worf.
I mean, I guess they got to get rid of anybody with Loaf before they go back to San Francisco.
Yeah, they absolutely
do. In the 1800s, right?
Yeah, Data can pass for French, but I don't think Worf could pass for anything.
I mean, not even a baker, Adam.
Yeah.
That's more loaf than even a baker would have.
Yeah.
They get Worf to clear out. I guess Worf goes back and takes command of the entrepreneur.
Yeah, he's the most senior officer on board at that point.
This has got to be great for him.
They're really throwing a lot of bodies at this mission.
Yeah. So literally, like, Geordi, Riker, Picard, Counselor Troy... and the doctor, saddle up.
Adjusting synchronic distortion, 0.001. 0.002. 0.003. 0.004.
And they like shift into this crazy alternate dimension where everything's blue and there's a bunch of like heroin addict aliens sitting around with pulses of light going into their head holes.
This was a legit creep show.
Yeah. And it's like, it's back to this tone where it's like, oh, I wish this was the episode.
Yeah. It's like, you can't just intercut Event Horizon with Back to the Future 3.
Yeah.
She's been to a place you couldn't possibly imagine. And now... time to go back.
Where?
Back to the future!
But that's what they attempt to do here.
Yeah.
Geordi's on the Bop It, and he's put them he's put them into phase with this thing, and they're just sort of observing for themselves everything that Data described earlier. We got the weird glows of light going into these foreheads. We've got sort of a center husk that contains a lot of these little things of light. And then from a portal, a couple of people with a box full of these little glow worms comes in and refills the thing in the middle. And yeah. One of these guys has got a snake cane.
Yeah, and the snake is like a crazy little animatronic puppet.
It's a little like the Remick monster.
It's like some of the most inventive alien design and like weird alternate phase of reality shit that Star Trek has done. It's so nuts that it's butted up against Mr. Toad's wild ride of episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. So seeing this portal appear, and I guess only momentarily wondering whether or not to risk all of their lives at once to see if they can find Data, they all hop through the portal. The portal closes behind them, and then it's smashed to be continued.
Why'd they go in that thing?
No one discusses it. Picard goes in first, everyone follows, and then that's it. Like, if I'm Geordi, I think there's a beat where you're like, maybe we should like throw a probe in there or something.
Guys, we have procedures. This is not one of them.
It's like they all observed Data's death wish and were like, they found his death wish so compelling. They were like,
his name was Robert Paulson.
Yeah. Give me some of that. Yeah. So Worf is back up on the ship. Like, can you imagine? Like, all of the life signs are gone. Worf is now captain of the Enterprise field commission. What do you think he does?
Oh, man, the Worf eyes on that field commission would be so amazing to see.
That is what the smash to... That's what the smash cut to be continued should have been. Back up in the command chair, Worf is sitting in it. Worf eyes to smash cut. That's what it should have been.
That would have been so good.
We were deprived.
It wouldn't have cost him a thing to shoot that.
You know what? Someone out there could re-edit that, taking the scene of Worf in the command chair from the Trojan Man episode from earlier in the season. We could perfect this episode, cliffhanger.
It would be a lot better.
Did you like it?
This episode, Adam?
No. Flatly? No, he said flatly. I mean, like all cliffhangers, I think it's really hard to like the first half without seeing the second, especially when so much has yet to be revealed. But I mean, this is a first half of cliffhanger that is made up of some fun scenes and some real dogs.
Yeah, it's like they had a writing team of like Shakespeare and a drunk baby. Like, half of it is amazing and half of it is so crazy.
I think we could probably discuss this when we do part two, but like, could this have been one episode if you just cut out all the fat? I think that's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that like there are lots of examples in season 6 and 7 of ideas like this being collapsed into one episode.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hopefully part two redeems in some way part one.
Fingers crossed.
Do you want to see if there are any P1s ready for our forehead hole?
Yeah, I gotta see what that husk has for my forehead hole, Adam.
Yeah.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have a commercial message coming in on Priority One Subspace.
Ship speech.
You can't even help slipping into Kevin, can you?
I've had a lot of podcast fluid to get me through this episode, Adam. Here is the message. anxiously awaiting Greatest Gen Con 2017? Need another bucket list con to attend? Love D20s? Starfleet officers, get down with all sorts of extracurriculars on the holodeck. Take some shore leave and come roleplay in Matamata, New Zealand. Who knows if I'm pronouncing that right? This October 13th through 15th at the Green Dragon Inn. Yes, the actual Hobbiton from Lord of the Ring movies.
Shut
Admission
up!
Admission includes a tour of the movie set, a gaming convention designed with families in mind. No Horgons needed. Find us on Facebook at PaizoCon Oz 2017. And that's P-A-I-Z-O Con Oz, O-Z, 2017. See you in the Shire. That is from Geek Cross Pollination, PaizoCon Oz 2017. PaizoCon Oz 2017 at gmail.com.
Holy shit, man.
I have probably pronounced most of that incorrectly, Adam, but that is the message, and that sounds like a lot of fun. That sounds amazing, actually.
Ben, I gotta tell you, PaizoCon is making me forget all about Greatest Gen Con. This sounds amazing. I want to live in the Shire.
It sounds better.
There's no way Greatest Gen Con is going to be as good as PaizoCon. Look, I'm just going to throw this out there, Ben. I'm going to throw it out there for the both of us. If PaizoCon wants us to be at their con, I'll go. I'll go to this. I've never been to New Zealand. It sounds great.
It does sound really good. I might not be able to make it because I have to move 3,000 miles from where I currently live around that time.
And oh, no.
I'm anticipating that being expensive. But we can talk for sure. I mean,
well, I'm not. I would never say that we would pay our own way to go to PaizoCon. I'm saying, if you're a PaizoCon and you're in the Shire and you're looking to maybe book a couple of great guests, guests with a great Star Trek podcast, that
talk
maybe
to
has,
our agent,
yeah, give us a call. Look, we're taking every meeting at this point.
Every meeting, even the ones that haven't actually been offered to us.
All right. If you're interested in PaizoCon.com, look them up.
Yeah. Why don't we get on to the next Priority One message, Adam?
Yeah, this one is a personal message, Ben. It is from Jim, and it is to Ben and Adam.
Oh, I know those guys.
It goes like this. I've nearly caught up with your frenetic release pace and wanted to both support you and express how much I love your pod. Also, I share Adam's interpretation of violations. The dark interpretation, I believe, is what we're calling that.
Yeesh.
He continues.
I was pretty content to never be reminded of violations ever again.
Yeah, me neither. And I was totally okay with being walked off of my weird interpretation. So here we are, back again. Jim continues. You can count on my continued viewership. P.S. Nothing makes me laugh harder than each season's veto and inevitable immediate counter veto.
Wait, that's not inevitable.
Jim is a big fan of how we do vetoes, and I think that puts him in the minority.
We hear a lot of people complaining about it, and I mean, it's been a coincidence up till now.
I think Jim's really lucky.
This is a season where I very badly misused my veto because I was expecting there to be more of a bad pun to warn me about the Lwaxana episode.
Your veto was a one-car accident.
The thing is, Adam, like, aside from the next episode, I don't know that there are a lot of episodes that I would veto going forward.
Yeah, I can't think of any, but I know there's another bomb out there. I know that there's one that people say is the worst episode, even worse than the one that we saw with the Lwaxana Troy Mudbath.
Well, thank you for the support, Jim, and thanks for writing in.
Yeah, I'm glad our Gmail rule auto-deleting any message that contains the word veto didn't catch this one.
Well, if you would like to email us for $100, like Jim did, or send a commercial message, like PaizoCon did, You can go to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message or $200 for a commercial message. It really helps us make this show. Thank you.
Yarmouk and Jalad at Tanagra.
Put your best foot forward and present your new business project or political thing as well as you possibly can on the internet. How do you do that? Not through some cookie cutter form on a social media website or trying and failing to code a pretty website yourself. No, you go to Squarespace, start using their completely new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint, which helps you choose from professionally curated layouts and styling options that help you build a unique online presence from the ground up that is tailored to your brand or business. Squarespace has been a super loyal sponsor of The Greatest Generation. We hope you will give them a try. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/scarves to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. This episode is brought to you by the spring cleaning champions, Manscaped. This season, make sure to groom your carpets and your drapes with the leaders in below-the-waist grooming. Clear out your winter bush with Manscaped's Lawnmower 5.0 and watch your confidence bloom like the springtime flowers. Hey, maybe you're getting away on weekends, getting into a swimsuit, into a sexy situation where you're not wearing pants at all. You want to look your best from head to toe. Get yourself some Manscaped products. You know, it doesn't just have to be your junk. You know, they've got the Beard Hedger Pro Kit and a Handyman Electric Face Shaver. They make great stuff, and I think you'll really enjoy it. And you'll get 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping with the code SCARVES at manscaped.com. Nothing like a little spring cleaning in your pants.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast, and we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second and go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Whether it's hundreds of years into the past or... even just a moment ago, did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible. Drunk Shimoda!
I did, Adam. Mark Twain is supposed to be one of the, like, the great geniuses of history. And he is depicted in this episode standing 5 feet away from two people he is trying to eavesdrop on, smoking a ridiculously big cigar.
Yeah.
What an idiot.
That is one massive cigar. It's like a cartoon bad guy cigar.
It really is. And it's like, did you think that the people 5 feet away from you that you're trying to not tip off that you're listening in on their conversation wouldn't notice all the smoke from that huge fucking cigar?
Yeah.
That's a Shimoda move, Adam.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean... Samuel Clemens' portrayal and his very character is Shimoda worthy, that's for sure.
Yeah. How about yourself? Did you have a Shimoda?
Yeah, I did. I'm going to give mine to Data, who chooses some interesting times to either conceal or betray his true identity throughout this episode. like he's gotten rich. He's in the corner suite at the hotel, which is very nicely appointed.
Yeah, he's on one of the Starwood preferred guest floors.
Yeah, it's great. he's befriended a bellman, And he's sending the bellman to go run errands for him. So he's giving him stacks of cash.
Bellman keeps showing him a piece of paper with a circle on it. You know, for kids.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, like, he's running these errands, and he's bringing him stuff, and one of the things he brings Data is an anvil. And Data being the smartest thing in the universe, forgets to keep up the burlesque that he is a Frenchman, conveniently enough to do it for laughs. So he picks up the anvil one-handed and walks it across the room before dropping it and complaining about his shoulder injury from the attempt. And then he brings the bellman over to his table workshop where he's constructed this device, this futuristic, like, static cling device with a bunch of, like, neon and switches and stuff. He does a thing at this table that is so weird. Like, he doesn't drape a blanket over what he's built. Instead, he invites the bellman over, and they have a conversation over it. And then he looks down at the thing, and he hits, like, a single switch as if that's the switch that's going to give away what this thing's true intention is. It's the fucking weirdest thing. Like, why is he messing around with this device? And what does that switch do? Why does he hit it when the bellman's there? I know I, like, headcanon the hell out of that moment, but, like, to me, it seemed like another example of Data with something to hide and being woefully unable to hide it when he chooses to.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck, Data?
Yeah, all of the rules about what Data's truth serum personality is like have gone out the window in this episode.
It's that problem where we know people are smart and they're written stupid.
Yeah.
That's the problem here.
Yeah, we know that Data's on sodium pentothal and he's written as though he's not.
Yeah, yeah. What do we have coming up on the next episode, Ben? Are we going to have a part two?
The next episode on the series, Adam, is season 6, episode 1, Times Arrow, part 2.
It's just Worf as captain of the Enterprise for a whole season.
Yeah. The entrepreneur crew travels between the 19th and 24th centuries in an attempt to prevent Data's death in 19th century San Francisco. Do you remember this episode, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, in as much as I remember this one... Like, what I'm hoping for is I'm preparing for disappointment and that it ends up surprising me and I end up liking it. Like, that's why I'm tempering my attitude against it down so far. Like, I want to be pleasantly surprised. I hope we get that.
Mm. So, vetoes are newly available to us. We have vetoes, season 6 vetoes. Do you, are you optimistic? Are you cautiously optimistic enough not to use your veto?
I just sort of have a standing personal rule that that I don't want to use a veto on a two-part episode.
Okay. Well, didn't you try to use a veto on a two-part episode at some point?
Did I?
I feel like you might have.
Oh, no. Well, I can change, man. I can change and you can change. I've learned a lot while doing this show, Ben.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. Oh, I'm not going to veto either. So, Time Zero, Part 2, we shall watch next.
Deal.
Adam, our viewers support us in many ways, big and small. They leave iTunes reviews that recommend our show and help us rise in the ranks on iTunes. They tell their friends. They go to MaximumFun.org and click on Donate. And donate to our show.
They buy the merch, the glassware, and the shirts.
Oh, yeah. They go to that Max Fun store. That's good stuff, Adam.
They enrobe themselves in our jokes.
Yeah.
And drink out of them, even.
So thanks to everybody that does that. And everybody that doesn't do that, consider not being such a Freddy freeloader.
Our thanks, as always, to the great Dark Materia for our theme and interstitial music, as well as Adam Ragusea for all the rest of our music, which has sort of turned into a lot.
Yeah, we should put people onto the hashtag GreatestGen, which is the way people talk about the show on Twitter. There are also Facebook and Reddit groups that you can get involved with. They're both real fun places to hang, crack-wise, and talk with other people that follow the program.
We're on Instagram and Tinder.
Yeah. We are uncut and 420 friendly.
No drama.
No drama. And with that, we will be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek The Next Generation and an episode of The Greatest Generation that is Worf eyes into commercials every single time from here on out.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.